today, because Dave is not going to sit at the table, there's room for whoever can't sit at the table to sit at the table. So sit at the table. Because I was concerned about two things after the last class. One is the equal distribution of conversation. What I want is I want to encourage contributions to the conversation from everybody, which means if I am not hearing from people by a certain point in the class, I will then direct questions directly to you. Okay? It's the only way I can do it. And then I was concerned about not everybody doing the do part of these things. And there's do's most weeks. Like last week, to do was find one website using persuasive tactics. And, I mean, worst case would take 10 minutes. You know, if you can start looking at any sales site, from Dell.com to Walmart.com to anything, and you can find something, somewhere, something about it that's persuasive, or decide something's persuasive. I know we got last week a little bit into the question of the good and evil question, I guess. Are all the persuaders evil from some horrible corporate thing? And the Rich is in here. Rich in your defense of... is he?
No,
I don't see
he's
him.
He's not here.
In kind of defense of it, the word would be sanguine, meaning... No, not actually not bloody, but that's where it comes from. Their sense of of no great threat in this, and the ability to kind of, if not laugh off, at least shrug off the critique made by, not really mean persuaders, it's not a very scary movie, but Century of the Self, say. And to go, it's no big deal. And that's fine to do that, but ideal time to have done that would have been kind of back here. Because last week, we read this captology thing, and I don't think that B.J. Fogg, for his part, was making a judgment really either way. If anything, he was making a judgment that this is fine to do, you know, and that we're influenced, we can create software that will influence, you know, young people to use contraception, or you know, who knows what they would, what you know, come sit around the table if you can. But put your stick away, your dangerous stick. Did someone give you that, or did you buy it?
I bought it.
Okay,
yeah,
no, if someone walks in with something like that, there could be someone with a basket.
That's a free gift because he bought a membership.
There could be someone with a basket passing it around outside. No, it's
he got a gym membership. It was a free gift.
The last time I ate something on a steak, it was at an event where there's someone, you know, I can take it. I just want to make sure there wasn't food. I'm sorry. I'm always slightly hungry. There was food. I'm going to take a quick break. We're waving them in here for us. There are meetings here, you know, sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
That people will hold, and either before the meeting you can steal, or after meeting you can have food from their various bins. Welcome. You can sit over there in the horrible spot if you want. We've all anchored that spot in our psyche as the negative place. So I don't know what'll happen. I was hoping we could fit all pain. Paying around the table, but I guess you're strong enough.
You can add another section.
Those guys are at the table.
do some
well,
shuffling.
Well, he's not paying. He's an evil interloper.
I'm getting sex. I'm going to stay.
Wow, getting.
That's very kind of you.
What's your first symptom?
I cough. I feel crap. Do you have the flu?
I don't think the flu is out yet.
He's feeling so bad he passed up free food outside.
So who's our NLP conversation leader?
I don't think we designated anyone.
We always do. I'm going to have to use my NLP to figure it out.
See you. I accuse
you.
Do you need to talk to the
house? Okay, we can talk about it together. Or, why don't we start with our do's? Do for this week. And you all understand there's a paper due next week.
Yeah.
The most current thing will always be these little weekly lists of stuff. This is what's going on. This is always it. So anything printed or any course descriptions or anything are not as important as these weekly things. If something changes, it'll happen here first.
Today's the 19th.
Yeah. And this is turn-in papers on the 26th. Now remember, these papers, I've got this on email, they're not research papers, right? These are not, and it has nothing to do with Thesis Pub or anything I've been talking about elsewhere. It's true. It's not. I wouldn't try. This is such a short, small, and specific assignment. I would not try to tie this in to your thesis. I would really just write from a place of opinion and perspective, write your point of view about either one of these one of the arguments made in these things or from anywhere else. But all I'm saying is that when I say the paper must have a thesis, I'm not saying it should be connected to your thesis. I'm saying the paper must have an argument. It must pose a question and an answer. Proposition, an argument, or a conclusion of some kind, right? And if you're at all concerned or confused about what these things look like, or what an argument looks like of that sort, just go to the New York Times.
I'm in charge of that now.
Yeah.
So the op-ed page.
You just have to sign in, I thought.
Yeah.
No. Those little orange
this is not that.
This
is a long one. Are they charged with people in college?
Yeah. 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 Free to the department of law.
So there's some research. In fact, there are examples, right? The people bring up examples, but several studies show the trip over the North Pole is an average 5,000 nautical miles. So, I mean, there's facts in there that back up the case. And there's his conclusion. We need to pay attention. Let the sea change pass us by. You may use apostrophes differently.
What? Quotation marks.
Huh?
Quotation marks?
Yeah.
Style?
When was this? Where did they use it?
Oh, it's not in the article, it's a letter. This is at the bottom.
Not returns.
I guess they're just not allowing a couple of letters to indicate names, and they're putting in single quotes. So it's
Maybe that's the name of that.
It's a link that everything's on their line. They're probably distinguishing the proper titles.
Yeah. And they don't want to go italic. Yeah, it's tricky. I hate being the South Park. What? Well, is that their style? It must be.
Air quotes.
I hate making South Park. I hate making South Park.
It's more like this.
Oh, bullshit.
Inside of
it. He fucking loves it. He fucking loves it.
No.
All right, so we still have time. So hopefully, you got to see we showed the first half of, or the first two parts of Power of Nightmares on Monday, right? And it's also available. I mean, I'm watching it from this thing, which isn't as bad as all that. And then, so for next week, it'll be finished being read. And that'll be the last of your corporations in the military-industrial complex are evil and persuading us by immersing us in the land of horror. Cool. Okay, so the things to read for this week were these. And the thing to do was to find or perform an application of NLP or an NLP-like technique elsewhere. Meaning the find would be find NLP or an NLP-like technique. So what we should do, we should make it as threatening and horrible as possible. Because we'll start with that and then come back around to the discussion of what this is. Because the kinds of things you found or the kinds of things that you think are NLP or NLP-like will help us figure out as a group what we think this stuff is, and whether it works, you know, whether there's a reality to it. I mean, the obvious question that comes up on pretty much everything that we're doing is the question that people were starting to bring up last week, which is it ethical or not? And the other question is kind of, does it work or not? And the is it ethical or not question always ends up going into two places. Either it's ethical if you use it this way, but not ethical if you use it that way. In other words, it's ethical to use a persuasion technique to tell, you know, kids to use birth control, but it's not ethical to use a technique to tell kids that, you know, not to have abortion, say, or to buy McDonald's. And there's that way of looking at it, and then there's the other way of looking at ethics, which is the technique itself unethical? That even if you are using the technique to help kids not smoke, if it is a mind-numbing or cognition-paralyzing technique, then is it right to use it even for good? In other words, if you're going to have people not commit crimes because the Great Pumpkin will punish them and in the night if they commit a crime, is it a good enough reason to say, well, it keeps the people in line. There's less crime when they believe there's a Great Pumpkin who's going to kill them at night. Is that worth it, or is it unethical? And you can fall on either side of that equation. Then there's the other part, which I think is very interesting to look at. And for our purposes at this point, now that you pretty much know that I feel, you've read my book, you've seen my documentary, I feel manipulation itself is kind of fucked up, unless it's disclosed, is to look at what works and how does it work, which is a completely fair thing to look at. Even if you are, like, probably you in some evil, horrible way. You're going to use it for marketing or to sell to some advertising agency to make underage virgins drink alcohol.
Did I say that last month?
Yeah. You said that. You wanted to work for Adolf Coors. It's to look at what works and what doesn't, because that's all of these things, by the way I look at it, all of these things are technologies. NLP itself is a technology. And what works on the brain, what works on the psyche, It's interesting to know whether you're an advertiser, a propagandist, or an artist. So the next couple of weeks, we're going to look at some pure techniques and then come back around and look at some less likely people who are using what I think are the very same things, whether it's eToy or Artmark or, you know, great progressive lefties that we're all supposed to cheer, who are still using some of the same stuff. Meanwhile, I'll pass this around. This is the first real neurolinguistic programming book. All right, so you can look at it. It's very dry stuff, the way it's written. I mean, they do have pictures of people looking left and looking right, looking up and looking down, but it's all then done really with equations. You know, and whether or not abstracting things to equations works or should have been done, I mean, it's you know, externally pronounced words, internally pronounced words versus this, and, you know, visual people and sensory inputs, and I mean, it's interesting almost historically, even though it's as recent as, I guess, early 70s, to look at them trying to codify. This was actually copyrighted in the 80s, but I think it was written in the 70s, copyright 1980. To look at them in a primitive way, trying to codify everything that goes in and everything that goes out. Someone, who was it? I guess the thesis book was talking about, who was it, Kant? And ideas of, you know, objective reality versus a perceived reality. I mean, a lot of this stuff comes from that the human being is this, you know, perceiving processor and looks at all this stuff and then puts it through its own filters and then outputs it. It's just an interesting, little thing to look at. So, why don't we start since I started the book on my own? Can we start on this one? What did you find or punishment round? Is this yours?
No, but my fingers are important.
But no,
this is the, I mean,
punishment
round.
Did I catch
it's
the stick.
And that's why I sit over here.
Oh, but over there, things get thrown at you. Whose stuff is this?
It was
there. Really? How much of this are going in? And what does it do? What is this? Anybody know? Capacitor? What is it?
It's a transistor.
Transistor?
It's
a regular.
Yeah.
Oh, is it a regulator?
No, it's not.
It's going to hurt a little. It's going to hurt a little, but this is part of it. Okay, that's corporal punishment.
I'm sorry.
See, now everybody's scared, right? Yes. I hurt you with electronics. Really? You didn't do anything?
I know electronics. I have a huge project tomorrow, too.
I'm not the most important thing in your life? At all times? Well, that's all right. So now we do instead. What NLP can we do on him to make sure he does his assignments all the time? I think what I would do is be a therapist. In that sense, we understand that he's coming from a good, important place, and he wants the best for all of us, right?
What?
And for yourself.
That's what I want.
Doesn't he?
Yeah. I want the best for everybody and myself.
Well, of course he does. All people do. That's what he said at the beginning of the Hartman thing.
Is it in that order, though?
Huh?
Is it in that order, or self and then everybody else?
I only know by
the crowd. Is there necessarily?
I think so.
Does there have to be?
There doesn't have
it
to be.
It could oscillate. It could change moment to moment. True. I mean, when I'm coming at him with this, it's himself, okay?
First, we develop a rapport with
him. Oh, right. That's like punishment.
But according to that, to the radio show, you're either going towards something you want or running away from pain. So,
right.
So maybe running away from pain is going to work.
Right, this will be short term.
He was running, though.
No, he really was, a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah.
But in jest, because he knew I wasn't really going to hurt him. But this one, he was scared.
He was more scared when he asked him about the stick and food.
If you kept doing that to him, after a while, he would just give up. Because he wasn't getting the other type of motivation.
Maybe you're not reaching him.
Yeah, they use the example.
Maybe you need to change your
tactic to make it move faster.
Right.
So, like, if you continue to hook him, eventually
it'll stop working.
He'll be like, just hook.
But what would, if that's true, that whipping the horse doesn't lead to long term results? I mean, it's interesting. The example he was using was George Bush and the presidency. that by using fear, which is what Power of Nightmares is about, which like it's kind of fun that we watch at the same time, you get short-term results, like an election, right? But then you get long-term
apathy,
which is what we're in now. Unless that's the design, or unless they can stoke up the fear, keep it going. That's why most cults, even, you have to pull the trigger eventually and have everyone kill themselves, right? Because you can't just keep playing the fear thing forever.
That's not true.
You keep it going?
Now, most cults don't kill themselves. No, that's the exception.
If you're playing the fear game, and that's what you have to do eventually. Most good cults also have salvation game, though. You know, like Catholicism or Judaism or anything. Like Moshiach is either coming or coming back. Meaning, you know, Jesus, Messiah. You've got that.
Yeah, but that would mean that you... That's the combination of the two that makes it successful. That's what when I was reading this, I was trying to understand why Christianity had become so widespread that it's, you know, not considered anymore, but like the idea is that it spread to the New World and it was very popular, but it was a very slow process, and it's based, I guess if you really want to apply this, part of me does not agree with, I just want to reject NLP altogether, but like if you use their theory, it says that because Christianity promises a better future, and also you should avoid going to hell. By doing these things, you can avoid going to hell, but also, you know, look what you have to look forward to. That, it fits that mold. It says that, you know, you will, if you follow these rules of Christianity, you will be successful in this way. It's just like Roosevelt example, but that also follows their larger model about how it takes a very long time for it to be considered, like, successful. Christianity did not happen overnight. It happened, you know, you're probably the medieval scholar, you're much probably better at this.
Before medieval time.
Yeah, like just so long. Like being slaves in a Roman arena to, you know, like the ruling class of the world for a period of hundreds of years.
Well, the reward structure, I would argue the reward structure of something like Christianity, for it to work in a real NLP way, the reward structure involves something other than the promise of what happens when you die. The reward structure also, I mean, watch any of those good Christian meetings. The reward structure is in the moment, too. Because the other people who are saved in that moment and the music and the positive reinforcement, you know, it's like an Amway meeting or anything else where you get reinforcement.
Isn't Christianity like a little too big of a thing to look at in terms of NLP? Because there's so many variants. I mean, NLP seems...
Well, you can look at its components, though, as reinforcement.
It's like Calvinists versus Catholics. Like,
right.
They're using different NLP techniques.
I think that's what a lot of my problem with NLP is that it tries to reduce a very complicated structure of like emotions and thought processes into... That's a very pragmatic approach to the way you live. You're either this way or you're this way. You know, and it doesn't, you know, like what you're saying is Christianity is much too complicated.
Yeah, but on a person-to-person level, I think there's more to be, like, I'm not going to immediately say I believe everything that NLP says, but like when you get down to a person-to-person, a small group level, that's where they're really addressing things.
Well, that's normally where they're addressing things, but it's still, I don't think it's inappropriate to look at almost any... element, certainly a sacred ritual, in terms of the sights and the reinforcements, the use of colors, the smells, the sounds. Cathedrals are shaped in a certain way because they affect the way they make people look up. And making people look up does what to their neurophysiology? Well, maybe not everybody, but probably some 70 or 80% of people, when they look up, you know, it opens the air channel. These cathedrals themselves are inspiration engines. They are designed to do certain things. I even wrote about in Coercion, the way they have those little, what are they called?
Not the windows,
they're these little balconies that were made to make the space look mysterious and give people the sense something is behind something else. Things are grounded. Amen. You know, just the fact that you'll ground the prayers in amens, you know, so say us all, as they do on, what's it, Battlestar Galactica? They end with so say us all instead of amen, but it kind of makes you think about amen, because why? They took it out of our normal context.
It also depends a lot on the person that drives the ritual. This would be someone that is like very dry, someone who's like very charismatic, that can actually apply like NLP to.
Yeah, but if the yes, but if the ritual is defined well enough,
yeah,
it can translate to anywhere. I mean, you're a Jew. I promise. I mean, if you're a Jew, you're raised Jewish, you go to any country, it's weird. You know, I went to Spain, I went to Hungary, and you walk by a synagogue on a Friday night, and you're hearing during Shema Yisrael. It's like, you know, it's so grounded in your head is what it is, and the fact that it's the same all around it, boom, wherever you are, whoa, you're a Jew, all of a sudden. I mean, and it hits you on a really, on a shockingly profound level, you know, for a core, right?
I mean, it's interesting, because Judaism does maintain that community, but Christianity is sort of much more, like, mutable and, like,
well, with bloodshed involved, yeah. But it wasn't like they were all just, let's evolve this religion naturally.
No, but I mean, there's a lot of incorporation of rituals. You know, every culture they go into, like, they start incorporating the ritual, making them saints, so it's a much more flexible structure for the ritual itself, you know.
In that sense, also, is when, like, for example, like, small, like, all these small Protestant churches that the leader is not charismatic enough, then
it's evil. That's true.
Yeah,
that's true. But you take this, though, is still, this transference is still an NLP technique. So you have a culture that worships the mother, right? So you say, I'm trying to bring Christianity there, and we'll say, okay, with these guys, let's have Virgin Mary become, let's ground, let's anchor Virgin Mary with their mother imagery, so that what's her name up on the hill, the, you know, the bruja of the something or other, you know what I'm talking about?
And
becomes Virgin Mary, and we say, oh, but what this really was this. So you marry the two things, so that co-option itself is taking existing anchors and putting new names on them. You know, that's almost as NLP as it gets.
For Christmas. Yeah. Christmas is not a big Christianity at all. It's just fits in a lot of pagan festivals. So, yeah, well, I love a festival,
I do. Right, or as most people don't even realize the cross, which was a religious symbol before people were crucified on it. You know, this was then, you know, the Ankh and everything else. The cross was a super, super sacred pagan symbol that's like, so you put Jesus right on top of it. And it's like, oh, that's what it is. Tell us, or share with us, or do this. and you can have people, you can, if you want, you can take a person, up, sit them up on a chair and do it. It's okay.
Well, my example comes from, I went to see a play this weekend. It was a monologue, Tom Paine, and it was...
it was about Tom Paine, the Patriot guy?
No, but it was, the title was probably a reference to the main character, but he's talking to the audience the entire time. And a lot of times he comes into the audience, the actor on stage, and he's very polite with the audience, saying how nice it is to see us and how great we are and stuff. But when he returns to the stage, he basically is scorning, like, love and scorning, like, life and these things. And it seemed like a very NLP-esque dramatic form, where he's coming into the audience literally and saying, you know, trust me, I'm your friend, and using these words like, you know, to us, kind of giving us, like, I see you and I feel you, these kind of things. But then going up there and, like, divulging these kind of...
When he was in the audience, was he the character or was he now the actor?
No, he was the character the entire time. And it worked, and especially in forms of, I think they mentioned in the article how if you're reading a book, trying to achieve a trance-like state, and they talk about if you read, if you're really into a book, and then it dives into a subplot, and then another subplot, you become immersed in that. It seemed like this was a good example of that, because every time he would come to the audience and get us on the side again, he would go up and start telling another facet of the story, and it was very translated.
It's cool. So it's almost the framing, reframing. It's both rapport on the one hand, just by being, but then also framing and reframing the thing.
Mm-hmm. And it is very trance-like, and then
it's totally trance-like. It's like, that's why I just love, in Coercion I did it, because I just love whenever anyone does it, you know, when you say, as you read the words on this page, you know, that sets that kind of frame short circuit on in the head. You know, I mean, commercials now use it all the time, but it's almost weirder in text or in theater, you know.
So if you can convince the audience in a play, like use NLP tactics, or I guess any play could technically be under NLP because they're using linguistics to kind of talk to the audience.
It's interesting. I mean, in some sense, you could say all theater is NLP-esque. And what elements does it have in common? It has the proscenium arch, which is framing. It has sexy people on stage, ideally, which is rapport. It's all language. I mean, theater is language. It came from, you know, the epic poem. Unlike a film, which is visual, which is a whole other thing, it's definitely language. And it has a story nested inside it. So you have people now playing a story.
And this one heightens that because it's a monologue of a character addressing the audience the entire time, much like a speaker at a convention.
Yeah.
Also the training for improvisation and method training for theater, where if an actor has to say the same thing 50,000 times because they have to perform on Broadway every night, when they have a good night, then they can feel the words. But what happens when they don't have a good, you know, they don't feel so well, they have to somehow fake it. And some of the training is very NLP-like. They do training where I'll be looking at you and then I'll describe that your mouth is kind of open and now you're starting to smile a little bit, you're nodding your head a little bit, you know, and then,
uh-huh.
And that kind of thing, they're trained in it, whether they know that it's NLP or not. So I think there's literally those techniques embedded in the training.
Sure, acting teachers, I think, are practitioners of NLP, like Meisner, like you're probably having
it. Well, between the whole Meisner thing, which is that language back and forth, blah, 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 and then sense memory and... Because NLP people, it's always, well, can you remember a time when you were like that? I mean, they always take away one ability and try to transfer it into another. So if someone was really good at throwing a football, but terrible at public speaking, they say, well, how do you feel? Describe the feeling when you're throwing the football. When you're throwing the football well, and say, oh, will I feel like it? You know, and I can feel the wind, and I can feel that. And then you get them to imagine those feelings when they're public speaking, and in theory. They don't need to take pills in order to speak them. So that's cool. Did you get spacey at all when you were thinking about it? I mean...
During the play?
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, things are said that make you kind of think, and then you kind of lapse back into what he's saying later on. I don't know. I think any good theater kind of spaces you out.
Yeah, because for me, there's this thing. I don't know if everyone gets this one or not. When I realize there's something trance-like happening... I get, like, I don't know, this double trance weird feeling. In other words, that...
Flashback.
Almost. It's almost... No, it's not a psychedelic feeling as much as the realization of the trance happening is also trance-like. It's that thing that happens, the reason why people crash their cars when you do NLP on them. It's this moment of disorientation. That I guess you only really realize how disoriented you are when you reorient back to normal. When you realize the thing has happened. That there's been this, you know, it's like that Star Trek glitch, you know, or the Matrix. When that thing, when the deja vu moment happens, it's after that you go, huh. But it's weird, there's tons of it in Dianetics. I was reading Dianetics. Found it at my mom's house. I don't know if she ever read it. You know, it's the original Scientology book. And they said, if you don't understand what you just read, then you won't be able to, you know, then you can't really go on in this book. And I was like, did I understand? And then I was realized, oh, they're just, you know, bleh at me. But the minute you kind of, it's like, there's that moment. It's weird. I wonder, you know, like someone watching a Shakespeare play, and they watch it, and they have a play within a play, and the play within a play then reflects on the bigger play, and then you come out of the play. People just sit and watch it. And is the feeling different when if you realize it and if you don't? You know, the NLP guys seem to think that you can know what's going on and it still works. What did you find? You don't know how he did it?
I feel the differences between the person who knew about NLP and then the other person doesn't know anything about NLP. And when I was very busy, the other person asked me what she was doing until next morning, and I will listen if I know. But the other, you know, the person who knows about NLP asked me something to relate to it till next morning.
Do you have any idea, looking back, on what technique he used, or?
If I do this, it could be good thing for me. He was very clear. Why I have to do this till before next morning, and then how it is important to him, or if it is important to me, or if it is important to the company. It was really
cool. But you like the company already? Did you care about the company? But when he spoke about it, you did.
Yeah. When I was speaking with him, somehow I believe it should be good for him. So he was really good at choosing words. He was very energetic. And he makes people get so involved.
I guess it's rapport, but I wonder, did you feel good then if you say you'd go home and work on it overnight maybe? At home or at office? Do you remember how you feel when you actually did the things? Did you feel good while you worked? Or did you feel, fuck, he fooled me again?
No, I didn't feel like that. When I finished my job, so it was kind of reward. Good, maybe a lot. You know, only the job.
And you still like him?
Yes.
But do you think some of it was because he was your boss, or he had some expertise?
I think so. Yeah. So because, you know, I don't really care about the boss, but I don't have to do the extra job.
Yeah.
So I can say no.
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, sometimes after reading all this kind of stuff, I'll look at a boss in a situation and be much more suspicious of their cheer. I mean, there's people who do it badly because they've just read a book and they're running the McDonald's and they're using basic NLP on the employees. And you see it. You know, that's good. Clean that floor. Floor looks good when it's clean. Good job, Dan.
I know, but weren't we talking about that last week or something, where, like, sincerity and flattery, and even if you don't believe it, didn't you say, Abe? Like,
it works!
It works!
Yeah.
Is that not me?
Well, partly. I mean, you could say it's Dale Carnegie or anybody. you know, any of the original, just have good thoughts. Man, that's beautiful. Kitchen floor you've got.
Then you can grow rich, right?
Yeah.
It's if you want to be, not, if you want to be more for someone, anyway, you have to do it. And if it's encouraged by the people, it's more fun.
Do you have to do it? I mean, I guess this is getting back to the ethics and efficacy question. If everybody else is doing it, if you are a lawyer, you know, for the defense, and you're just presenting the facts of the case, and the prosecutor is using NLP, and every time he refers to your client, he does a gesture that he's already anchored in the audience's, in the jury's mind with murder. Right? So you start out, you tell the story, this girl was brutally murdered. She was murdered, she was killed with blood and death and gore and pain, and she died. Murder, 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 rape, rape, rape. Right? And so this is down for the murder and rape and blood. Their client was there that day, he was blah, blah, blah. He's wearing a green shirt, he has a beard, he has glasses.
He's always here.
That makes me a commie.
He's a commie.
Poor Ben.
And what do I do? Now I'm the defense guy, and I'm like, he wasn't there. He was in California at the time. Here's a videotape of him at California when the murder happened.
Yeah.
All right, here it is, okay? Okay? Murder! 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 And it's upsetting, right? I mean, that's how Bush got elected, right? Basically. I mean, that's what, you know, what's his name? Lakoff, this California linguist guy, is all upset about. That he feels that, you know, Bush people reframe his arguments in those sort of ways. Interesting. I mean, the litmus test, in her case, I mean, even though, and it would have been great if you figured out what he did, or looked at some old memos or something that he wrote to you, or found, you know what I mean, go back and find the thing, so it doesn't feel so general. But the limit is that she, you know, had more than one boss, and this was the one that she and everyone did stuff for. And the remarkable thing, and there's no resentment about it. There's no, so he's using a technique. It's good for the company, and made her feel, when she's doing the assignments, she feels okay about it. And it wasn't because, oh, we're going to be in trouble as a company with that. It's because this will be good for us, good for me, good for him, good for the company. It's all the positive kind.
I think it's because I'm a little bit, you know, I work for magazine company, and if we do a good job, we can get good people to be here. So that's kind of thinking. It's not a creative job, just you have to do it like math or something. Like kind of thing, it could be
painful,
but for me, it's just
encouraged
to create.
And it also seems that he knows that, or he's somehow intuitive that you're a, what is it, go towards goal person, not a go away from non-goals person. And so by approaching you by saying how everything's going to be good for you and the company, it's versus like, oh, we're really going to do this or we're going to be in trouble. That's the way to get to you.
So, interesting thing is, he didn't mention if you didn't do this, you would have failed something. He didn't mention anything.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying.
I wonder if he did to others. If you could read other people and know that, oh, this person is less attracted to success than they are afraid of failure. Then you use that instead. You know, this company really needs you, or we're going through a really stressful, dangerous time now.
Isn't that where it really becomes programming then? Because like you have people, they might have a technique and they're not really aware of it, and it only works on certain types of people. So it's when they become aware and are able to use it, have different techniques
for different people. Yeah, but then you're saying it's programming, and I guess it is. If you have commercials that are customizable, if you're just doing a mass commercial out there, then it's just a commercial using a technique. If you're able to send one commercial to people who think one way and a different commercial to people who think another way, then you are literally programming the TV set to the at least a group. Ultimately, it's, I mean, it'll be interesting when it is to the individual who's watching.
Do marketers collect this data? Do they have like, oh, this person's in whatever group we've typecast them, and they're visual, or and they're.
No, but it's going to be pretty easy to infer what that is once you do enough data on enough people. You get a sample of 50 people and find out who's visual, who's audio, who's this and who's that, and then you ask them the 100 other questions. And then you cross-tabulate the responses, and you find out if someone has a cat, commutes more than 10 miles to work, has call waiting on their phone, and has four doors on their car,
it's like
then they're visual.
Profiling.
Yeah. That's pure axiom. I mean, that would work.
And also, I think a lot of them, even though they might not use the same language that we're using here, and all the time, like figuring out the angle of taking and convincing people in the same way. For example, like with the flu shot, again, it's really hard to get people that don't get a flu shot to get one. They're really set on either they always do or they never do. And we're not using this language, but the thing we're talking about is, you know, do you go the angle of showing people what will happen if they get the flu and showing people sick and try to freak them out? Or because people don't realize how serious it really is. Or you go the angle that, you know, you're showing people that they will relate to as themselves, really happy and healthy and cool with their family, which is essentially, you know, this, but it's just not.
I would argue you show the pain. Why? Because you need one action one time and then do it again next year. You know what I mean? I think once a year you can frighten people into doing something. As opposed to, like, good diet, you'd probably have to do it positively, you know, not eating cholesterol or sugar or something.
I'm not upset about that pain argument. So I keep thinking of, like, you know, you can tell somebody, like, don't touch. Like, I went to some restaurant in Chicago when I was a kid, and, like, they served bread on this hot stone. I was like, don't touch the hot stone. Of course, I'm like, shh. But now I'll never touch a hot stone again, you know, like, after I've got that pain, right? But it's like, it's called
skin. That's not really the same thing, though.
No, but it's like you learn from that, like, that pain, like, once that internalized.
Yeah, but the real pain is, real internalized pain is different than threat of pain. In other words, if you use, you know, people's fear of another 9/11, that eventually, I think that wears thin.
Like crying wolf. Like,
and I don't know if it can translate to other things. You're not going to touch a hot stone, but, you know, you will...
Like a place like Belfast, like lots of people would be way too afraid to go there, or would have been. But the people who lived there became totally immune to the fear that they legitimately had. And I mean, a lot of people there have terrible mental illness from dealing with this stuff for so long. But, you know, the threat of the fact that if you enter your chip shop, you could get bombed, and the constant threat from the paramilitaries on both sides that anyone's a legitimate target, people eventually just started ignoring them because they just got bored and they couldn't live their lives and they believed it, but they just didn't care anymore and they were like a flawed force. I mean, it's not that it didn't damage them, but it didn't really change the way that they behaved in the ways that you might think.
It's true. I mean, look at the terrorist threat to New York, the fake terrorist threat from a couple of weeks ago, coincidentally the day of the Bush speech about trying to redirect America's attention to terrorism. I'm sure it had nothing to do with it. But if that had happened in 2002, or even 2003, shortly, you know, I think we would have had more of a New York reaction than now. I mean, everyone was on the subways. I mean,
we've been on Code Yellow or Code Orange since 9/11.
Yeah, so that's what
you just got to meet them.
Who cares?
But it's also funny because it's like bombings are like the inverse of like the lottery. You know, what you're saying, describing is like the exact opposite thing happens when it's a statistical probability to actually be at the place where the bomb goes off. But it's a constant threat, people stop caring. The same thing with the lottery, like, it's impossible that you're actually gonna get a winning ticket, but then everybody goes out and buys one.
I know, they still do one, but it's the positive thing versus the negative one. I mean, it's a great proof of it.
Not only that, though, because it's like, the odds of you getting $1 million without buying a lottery ticket are way lower than if you do buy one.
No, I'm sure about that.
Like tomorrow, like I'll get $1 million.
No, yeah, finding a briefcase or whatever.
Everybody will go in on one.
Yeah.
I mean, but the reason you go in on it is because of magical thinking and other weirdness that, you know, God loves me right now, and, you know, that's crazy stuff. I would never do it. If you are above average intelligence, and I mean just truly above average intelligence, then it makes less sense to buy a lottery ticket. If you're a stupid person with no chance of making any money, then it does make sense. Because there's some smart people who are throwing their money in there too, stupidly.
Not really.
You know what I mean? But if you're smart, you are now lowering, you had the odds on your side with your money and your investments when you're smart. And you throw your lot in with everybody when you do that. Well, that's just the logical approach. Go for it. We need the money in our schools, right? We should get rich people paying for it rather than just poor lottery people. Did you find something, or did it?
Yeah, well, I was thinking, because it always shocked me and made me mad every single week. Right next door in my hometown in Mexico, there was like this very little obscure Protestant church that had very little people.
And little people or people?
Well, no, like two or three people. And then a new guy came. He was very charismatic. And the church grew tremendously. And you could hear how the whole thing started. It was first like a girl singing, like very softly. And then they would like start increasing the tone. And then the guy would start speaking, and then they were like getting ready mentally. You could follow the whole thing in like a very consistent way. And how he was like, he was sort of like talking about like people's feelings and things that were going on to get his report and get his like close connection with people and get him to do the sacred part of the thing, and then asking for money, and then end the thing. But it was like, first of all, it was to get into the mood of being in the church with the soft singing. And then the sound would start, like, eventually would start increasing. And what was annoying is that there was a Christian rock concert every Sunday morning right next to my window. And it was very loud, and you could not talk to them about it. I mean, there was no human reasoning possible to ask them to just keep it down.
Why should they? They're bringing people to Jesus.
Yeah, and the thing is that their rationale was so scary that you could hear people yelling and screaming and jumping around, singing in the praise of God, and you could feel like these guys are just one, they're just gonna burst out the door and start killing people. In the name of God.
That's where it took you.
Yeah.
At least, yeah.
It was very intense.
It was hypnotic and romantic and all that. But what were the most specific technique? You know, how would you relate it to what Hartman or someone else would say is a pure sort of NLP insight?
He would talk to people and get to kind of like get a sense of what they were feeling, and then he would talk about that and speak. Oh, I was talking with so-and-so about leaving for the service, and I know they're going through these problems, and it's the problems that people are going through, like financial problems and problems with their wives and stuff like that. So creating this like close connection with people to get them involved, and then to actually start improving the rhythm, and then get them to keep money and live happily place after the event. So, I mean, it was very well planned, and the church grew tremendously in like 5 years. It multiplied like crazy. And I think he was using some of these techniques just to get closer to people. You could see them talking to people and how he would just like do a rapport. Yeah, to get connected and then start asking them for things, and then they would completely become hooked into it. I mean, I even met people from school that were going there. And then what they realized was like, this is nonsense. They just stopped going. But in that moment, it was important to them, and that hooked them. And then they went there for a few months, and then they would just leave.
I mean, a real salesman only needs it for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, it's harder to get someone especially if it's not actually serving them. And that's the thing. If it does serve them, though, if it gets reinforced then in a real way, like if you use NLP to help people, you know, get flu shots or eat better, and then they're feeling better as they eat better, then you've actually created a positive cycle. It's anchored in actually feeling good. I mean, it's how people, you know, learn sex or anything else. Like, there's payoff. I mean, once they're positive, or eating, it's like eating is positively reinforced because my hunger goes away and I ate this food. I mean, if every time you ate, you were sick, you probably start to associate the taste and eating with.
And I was very angry at him. And then I would tell him in store, ask him to, like, shut up. Yeah, I literally, we did it several times. And
you said, shut the fuck up?
Yeah.
During their church thing? What'd they do?
They're probably just playing them.
The guy would come out, and he was like so calm that he would calm down.
Ooh, that's beautiful.
I don't care, you just like turn it down. Because I was so angry, but then they'd wait to just approach you. But if he would not always come out, really like someone else, like the sound guy or something. And then I would like get into fight with them. But the guy himself, he was very.
Yeah. But my wife and I have been attempting to use two techniques on our very noisy upstairs neighbors with a 5-year-old who jumps around from like, you know, 7 in the morning to 9 at night when our baby's trying to nap. I've been writing these really carefully constructed notes. And my wife, when the kids are jumping, she just goes, "Shut the fuck up!" And I think the combination cross-purposes.
So you're good at that.
In a way, but we're doing it the opposite way you should. I mean, my notes mean, all the niceness of my notes mean nothing if she's screaming.
So are you going to write mean notes now, or is she going
to? I guess I have to write mean notes.
No, maybe you should write notes which say, "I'm really worried about what my wife means."
Yeah.
Just bought this new knife set.
I got my wife teaching your kids how to curse.
Yeah. I just get it. My wife bought a BB gun yesterday.
How do you get fired at a job like
a random day? Well, at least they've got 2 floors, so at least let them run around on the floor that's not over.
My jobs are on random stairs.
Yeah, rather than on my baby's head. Now, that's a hard one. I think we're just going to move, believe it or not. We're going to move. Anyone has a place for us? What'd you find?
Like for the do?
Yeah.
The do, I did not believe the specific example about when he asked the audience if anyone has trouble waking up in the morning. Like, when they talked about the guy that has 5 alarms with 3 snoozes, and I have an alarm that has 2 alarms, and the snooze button is the most prominent thing on it, and I'll probably snooze 4 times. Which 9 minutes is 36 extra minutes. So I don't even understand what the point is. But I swear to God, last night I was like, here's the problem. So discussion, I want the class to hear this out. I can't figure out if I was moving towards something positive or moving away from something negative. But what I told myself was, tomorrow we need to get up, or tomorrow get up at 7:30 because you get to work with like this program that I really like, this virtuals. Every time I work with it, I'm really excited and I love all the stuff that comes out of it. But then in the back of my mind, I'm like, you also need to make sure that you do your industrial design project. You want to read some more of those readings for this class today. You need to make sure that you get the car changed, the oil changed in the morning.
So, the car?
Yeah.
It's
well, we live in Jersey City, so.
Okay.
But like, you know, like there's the responsibility aspect, and then there was like the, hey, you get this to look forward to tomorrow. But what I said to myself was, you get to use virtuals tomorrow, can't wait. You know, and sure enough, I woke up, but I didn't know if it was because I had to like take a car to Pet Boys, or if I had to like, if I was coming in to use the program. And I just couldn't tell. I just woke up and couldn't fall back asleep. And that never happened. So did I scare myself awake? I don't know.
Or did you entice yourself
I don't,
away?
Yeah. But it's very different from the rest. I used to think that the way my room is set up, it's so dark that I would have trouble waking up no matter what. like, it was my birthday. Mm-hmm. I think that's why kids, when I read that example, I was like, that's why kids are always easiest to get up on their birthday. Because they know they're getting presents. Because they're getting presents, yeah. I mean, but.
Well,
it's
really on holidays, and you got to go to the airport at, like, 4 a.m.
Yeah.
It's so much easier to get up than if you're going to work.
Yeah.
And if you have a job where, if you have a job where it doesn't matter when you walk in.
I still hate it, but I was.
You get up much later than if you have to be here at 8:30. If you're not here at 8:30, you're getting yelled at or whatever. You're there at 8:30, but if it's kind of more flexible, 9, 9:30, 10, it doesn't matter.
It depends how flexible it is.
That's not true because there's a lot of people I've known at jobs where you could have shown up any time who's still like every day when
well,
you get there, like you're even.
I'm gonna get there early today. I have a lot of stuff
to
do.
I'm gonna get up
right,
at 6 and you get there at 8 a.m. and like this. Dude's been there for 2 hours already.
But then
who's the best?
Those are all examples of like the moving away from pain because eventually it won't work anymore and you'll start showing up late because you don't care.
Unless it really is completely open. No, if it's completely open, I think you'll start going early because it's more fun.
I think it depends on how you're motivated. Like I am not motivated by the pain thing at all. If I have an absolute deadline for being in at work, I will always come in 10 minutes after. I don't know why I can't make it in, but being motivated by fear doesn't work for me. I just get resentful. I don't want to get off.
Yeah, me too.
I get pissed off. But if it's like, come in whenever you want, I naturally tend to come in much, much earlier than I have to. Because it's like, I'm coming in because I'm like, oh, I need to get this done. So if I get up, I get that done. I'm not a particularly good morning person, but I'll be in earlier than I will be the other way.
I think a lot of it had to do with what you said, though, was you get out at 6, so if you have to get there 2 hours earlier to make that mark to get out at 6 and then watch your show or go to dinner, that's the positive reinforcement. It's that time mark that you're gauging the, you know, when you should go in or when you should get up.
I mean, in some sense, it's enough just to set the time. I mean, it's an interesting thing. They teach you an S. They say, you know, you can wake up in the morning at any time you want. Just when you go to sleep, look at the clock, and tell yourself, you know, I will be awake, I will wake up at, and pick some precise time. You know, I will wake up at 7:03 feeling alive and rested. It works, that's the weird thing. And you go to sleep at 7:03, boom! You look up and you're like, wow, and I'm like, I should feel alive and rested. And in some sense, it's enough motivation to see the clock at 7:03, just to get that, whoa, that becomes a positive reinforcement, just that it works, but it does.
I hit the alarm, so I always get up 1 minute before it goes up. Always.
Yeah, because there is a clock in you somewhere that works as well as a real one.
That's actually a weird thing, because I think I always wake up 5 minutes before my alarm clock goes off. Mm-hmm. Like, whatever I set the alarm clock at, I always wake up 5 minutes before it goes off, and I go back to sleep and let it go off.
Yeah, you always do that unless you set the alarm clock improperly.
Yes.
In which case you sleep through it not ringing. You know, and that's weird too. So it's almost as if the program that wakes you up is the same thing that programmed.
So that your programming of the clock is also programming your brain.
Yeah. I think so. Well, come on. What better classical conditioning is there than you put the thing at a number and then wake up at that time and done it your whole life.
I mean, I would buy that because I think I've had my alarm clock for like 20 years or something, the same clock.
Yeah.
Like, and I do occasionally set it wrong, and it boggles my mind that I would set it wrong, and then I do sleep through it.
Yeah, well, that's a pure kind of Freudian slip.
It's the exact same clock for however many years.
My ex-girlfriend used to swear that she had set, you know, that she must have set the clock improperly. I'd be like, look, you don't know what you're talking about because it went off, you woke up, took it off, and went back to sleep. And I know that I do that sometimes, too. You know, it's like, I'm like, oh, the alarm clock didn't go off. No, the alarm clock went off. It was just, I was so damn tired. Like, I woke up, turned it off, and, like, locked that memory out of my head so I could imagine that I wasn't responsible.
My alarm doesn't use a lot of clocks.
You don't need one.
Sometimes when you're away from me, you can hit the snooze and it'll so you have to go get it. You have to get up and go get it.
That's kind of moving towards.
Just get a child, and you'll never sleep through it again. By the time you learn to sleep through it, they learn to walk.
It's And it just kind of phases into your dreams. If it's not like that noise, like if I leave it on the radio, forget it. I'll sleep right through it. I'll start dreaming about the bands that are playing on the radio. Howard Stern, if that happens to come on, which is whack.
I don't even like being part of one clock coldness.
Why don't people just go to sleep earlier or wake up later?
Reality is hard.
Eric and I were explaining, or I know we're having a conversation with this one day about the difference between morning people and like. Noah and I were basically, we would like stay awake late at night. We were like, at night, I don't want to go to bed because I just love being awake so much and I just don't want to go to bed. And so I put it off until I'm just so tired that that's all I can do. And then in the morning, I love my bed so much, I just want to stay there. And like for Eric, it's the opposite. He's like, oh my God, I can't wait to get to bed in the evening. It's like I'm just dying to jump into bed. And then in the morning, I'm like, oh, I don't want to be in bed anymore. Like, it's time to get up. I mean, those are just two different ways of approaching the same thing. It's not.
But at least they both have love in them.
I was just going to say that I had this alarm clock in undergrad that for some reason would only not work when I had midterms. It happened like 3 or 4 times where I just oversleep and it would work every single time. I'd make sure that it was on right, make sure it was not on radio. I don't know if something inside of me that had an anti-midterm. That was my point.
What did you think of?
I'm going to make an excuse first. I do have a couple examples, but I'm kind of confused as far as what neurolinguistic programming is to begin with. Because by definition, I mean, it's like it's basically just discovering a pattern and then we're just finding the best process available. I mean, there's been examples in the class so far of religion, there's been politics, you know, advertising dying to get into it because they want to be able to talk to you one-on-one if you're looking at a billboard or they have a salesperson in front of you. So it almost seems like to me it's everywhere.
What is it if it's everywhere and people are doing it? And obviously people were doing neurolinguistic programming before the word neurolinguistic programming existed.
Well, the other question I have for you is
start there, then what is it?
Well, they spend like a lot of time in the beginning of this. I was really frustrated by it. Just qualifying the fact that this is a model that's existed forever. What they're talking about is specific techniques within the model.
That the more conscious we can become of the way these things work.
Alienated
because you came in late. It's negative reinforcement. I get it. This really doesn't hurt, though, is the problem.
I don't fear you.
I mean, it seems like from a lot of the examples, it's personalizing a message.
That's what he's saying. It's personalizing it to the way that someone's going to respond. If they're a visual person or an audio person or this person. I mean, but there's not a lot before NLP existed as a word, as a way of codifying what we're talking about, there weren't a lot of people consciously looking to see, when I talk about the past, does she look up left or down right? So that I know when I want to reassure her or change the way she understands her past, I know whether to gesture up there or down here.
Has anybody done studies on like fortune tellers and stuff? I mean, they obviously have a lot of these sort of skills.
A lot of people have a lot of these skills naturally. I mean, just to have an inflection range in your voice. You know, there's people who talk like da-da-da-da-da, you know, that sing-song whatever way. Milton Erickson had great techniques that they talk about in a lot of these writings, you know, these induction techniques. Sure, a lot of them he was able to codify. A lot of them he was able to write down. A lot of them, I'm sure, worked because he was doing it and not me, right? Because he knew stuff either subconsciously or consciously that he wasn't saying or had some natural rapport or ability. Yeah, sure, psychics are going to pace and lead. They're going to breathe with you and find things. They're going to do stuff. Great actors, some of them just do it instinctually, but if they have an off night, they suck because they don't really know what it is they're doing, right? The only reason you go to acting school is for the nights that you're not really there. Well, that's not true, but that's what you want your technique for. You know, it's for when you're not inspired.
That's the Jimmy Stewart school, that thing where you just don't take any acting classes at all and just leave.
Yeah, but Jimmy Stewart played Jimmy Stewart. Right? I mean, what was his real range when you think about it?
Isn't that how when you go to cast for an actor, then, you know, if you want somebody who's over the top, you get a Pacino or something, or if you want somebody who's going to be, you know.
Well, there's different philosophies. And there also are people who have a wide range of roles they can play. I mean, what I would consider a true actor, a true stage actor, who can play anything from here to over there, because they're like an instrument.
Hotel Rwanda, what's that guy's name?
He was in my class at CalArts. I directed him in Macbeth.
So he's got a lot of range, but then he ends up as a supporting character, and then you have to ask.
Because he's black! Because he's black acting in America! I mean, what do you think? You know, this is. I'll tell you, there's racism here. Go on! It's over. No, but I mean, you're right in that this stuff exists all the time. And it's part of what makes it hard to come down too hard on anybody who's using these techniques, because there's a lot of people using them unconsciously. So why should I be punished if I have no rapport, I have no charisma? Why should I be punished for doing what charismatic people can do?
The other question I have about it is, you know, when we're giving an example of somebody who's in church, you know, that's different than, say, a situation where someone's in a missionary, you know. Because in it, well, the whole class here is about persuasion and coercion and making somebody do something that they wouldn't normally do. And
not necessarily,
but with NLP, I mean, you can. Yeah. I mean, well, I guess you kind of hit it on the head when you said that people unconsciously do it.
Or aspects of it, but I think that the idea, at least, and the people who are heavily involved in NLP believe that they have learned things about human behavior and brought things into consciousness that were only automatic before. And if you're able to bring
automatic for some people.
And automatic only for some people. If you're able to bring it into consciousness, then yeah. It's a technique.
Everyone's aware of the technique doesn't suck.
Does it stop working? I would think they say it doesn't stop working. You know,
and he said that the when you compliment each other, or whether you know it's flattery or it's a compliment, it still makes you feel good. But when you get to like hang out with people that are just everything is this bubbly, cheery stuff, it's just like,
well, see, there are opposite things
off. It's what you can't deal. With the compliments or with everything.
Ever watch C-SPAN? See a session of Congress. It's like the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. They get up. Oh, thank you, distinguished gentleman.
That's just manner. But if you know it well enough, they might say distinguished in a way that means fuck you, or distinguished in a way that means I agree.
Every time I talk to a client, it's hi, how are you? And then I try not to say that because it's like they don't really want it. You know, it's like it's just a pleasantry you throw in there, but. But, like, take the military, which is the opposite of what Sean's approaching, where, you know, you get so used to just the pleasantries that you know there's not really a lot of meaning behind it, you know. They do the opposite, where they, you know, when you're in boot camp, they're treating you like crap, and you're a maggot, and they don't, you know, they don't emphasize on a particular aspect of you to make you feel better, to make you into a better soldier. Instead, they use kind of, like, negative reinforcement.
But they're using classical conditioning.
Yeah.
That's actually changing, by the way. The Israeli army now, some units.
I mean, the American army. And now you can wear these special tags, blue tags, if you feel you've been the Paris Island has these now. You wear a blue tag, which means I'm feeling blue, having a blue day. And the drill sergeant's not supposed to yell at you so much then if you're wearing your blue tag.
Have you read that in the battle as well?
Don't shoot me! I'm feeling shitty. No, I mean, but I don't give you a reframing pass on this one. In other words, the issues that you raise are issues that they raise and that they acknowledge. But there's no way you can get through a few of those, even just those Hartman radio transcripts, without seeing, okay, here is a person who's actually breaking down aspects of human behavior in a way. Yes, people have had different handshakes for a whole bunch of time, but if someone writes a book on the handshake And here's, you know, after many years of practice and looking at lots of people and analyzing all this, when you shake the hand, if you use this part of the hand to do the handshake, you're going to be able to influence the person in that way. If you let go of precisely this moment, you're going to do that. There are people, very few, who are those great handshakers and who can change people around them using the handshake, but just because human beings have unconscious reservoirs doesn't mean that codifying them and writing them down is all of a sudden means that NLP is non-existent. You know what I mean? Economies exist, right? Economies exist. People are trading and all these economic rules. So Keynes comes along. Milton Friedman comes along. And they create these huge models for how money works and transacts. And you can say, well, the money was transacting like that anyway. So what do we have to read Keynes for? I mean, supply and demand's always been there, even though we didn't understand it as such. You know, that's NLP is putting itself, at least is positioning itself that way, and understanding itself as, now if we look rationally at the way people's brains work and all that, then we can be in charge, either of ourselves or of other people, depending on how you use it. Now, the way they describe it on there, it seems like, to me, an extremely ethical thing. What you're trying to do is give people access to their own software so they can program it themselves, get their hands on the keyboard. Of course, the way most people who buy these books intend to use it is to get someone else to buy something. And you gotta wonder, there was a time when there were a lot of people were bringing NLP into the courtroom, and I had to do all these interviews right in the same like 6-week period. Is this ethical or not for lawyers to be doing NLP? And now, part of law school. I'm sure they teach it here. Part of it, if you don't know NLP, you're at a disadvantage because the other guy is using it. You have to at least know how their jury selection is being done, and because when they ask the questions, they're looking and checking and whatever for prevarication, is that what it's called? For lying. they're using it when they're angry at different things in the process.
I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm just saying that it doesn't make sense to not use it, and it's pretty much prevalent everywhere in that sense. Because people, it's like saying a salesman has to sell themselves before they sell anybody else. If they kind of try and sell something and they're not all into it, then it's going to show. Like Sean was saying, if somebody's going to greet you and they don't really care, you're going to notice it over somebody who really cares.
Yeah, but then the question is, and let's use this as the example. There's a salesman who is using NLP to sell a thing, and then there's a salesman who's not using NLP, but genuinely, 100% body and soul, believes in that thing, and believes how it will help the person that he's trying to sell it to.
Doing it most of the time. Not all cases, but...
I mean, I wonder who would be the better salesperson in that instant. I mean, if you really believe in something but are feeling not well that day, then probably the NLP guy will still do better than you. But people who really mean it...
But also, I think you can get better and worse at this stuff, too. I don't think, like, if you genuinely believe in a product, you're just, like, an amazing NLP representative. You know, like, you might just be kind of a clod that doesn't want to relate to people, but you love this product. But then you can read all this stuff about, they say eye accessing doesn't work. But you can read how to relate to somebody, how to physically relate to somebody, how to use the same kind of words they do, and you get better. So I think
it's kind of like letting the trained sales pitch just take over.
Yeah, but that's why you're hoping that there are people who are on a certain level impervious to the sales pitch. In other words, a Supreme Court judge, say. You know, if someone's using NLP, going to the Supreme Court and say, and here's why we have to teach that evolution, you know, it just didn't happen. And why we have to teach the Bible in school. And blah, 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 NLP at you, blah, blah. And all the judges are like, oh, I love him so much. And then the guy says, well, you actually really still should teach Darwin in the schools for all these reasons, but he's, and uncharismatic. And the judges are like, ooh, I feel cold when I look at him. We would hope the judges are using faculties other than whatever is being done to them. You know, when we don't, if we could say, well, we don't care about it when people are choosing candy bars, or we don't care about it when people are choosing brand of automobile. But then there is a point at which we're hoping that someone is making a decision on something other than how their programming is being touched, no?
But also, I mean, so it seems redoing the readings of NLP takes so much from hypnosis. And it's like been shown, like, you know, in research that, like, hypnosis works with only hypnotically subtle little people. And you can get somebody who's hypnotized to do anything they would could imagine themselves doing. But you can't get them to do things they can't imagine themselves doing. And that's just true. They've done lots
of times. But not imagine. So you can't get them to murder, you know.
Exactly.
But you can get them to dance like a chicken.
Yeah.
You can get them to buy a Whopper, you know.
But I mean, what I'm saying is that...
So they're not going to put someone to death.
But not everyone. But I agree with you that I think certain people will know that it's happening. They'll be like... I mean, I don't know if I buy the NLP statement that even if the person's aware of it, it works every time. I don't think that's necessarily true. Otherwise, you know, it seems to me that, you know, wouldn't the NLPers be running everything if they were as...
Sure.
If their techniques were as powerful as they say.
Frank Lance, right?
George Lakoff would say that Karl Rove is doing NLP, precisely NLP, on the American public through the way he stages George Bush's events, through the way they rename conservative initiatives and reframe the debate. You know, the Swift Boat People Against Kerry was anchoring Kerry's image in something else by bringing Jane Fonda and John Kerry into the same picture, something that never had happened when they were trying to say that Kerry was against the Vietnam War on that order. They were anchoring him in something else.
But doesn't mean it worked. Maybe it does work, but it still only convinced half the people. You know, they still only convinced half of America, and it was a line, and George Bush won by a margin.
So well,
not everybody, exactly, right. If you did. So it's not like it convinced everybody, it worked for enough people.
That's another reason that makes me wonder about neuro-linguistic programming, because in the radio article, he's talking about the different types of people. You have people that, you know, are visual, you have people that are more touch.
Right.
You know. Well, if you try and do that on a broader basis, like a political campaign, you know, it's...
That's
only
what Abe was saying. It doesn't work. It's not programming if it's not individuated. That's why what Kerry's campaign tried to do, but they weren't sophisticated enough, was they created individualized ads for different households. And they went with Palm Pilots and played these little... They played the little ads to the homeowner because they found out what they thought they knew about the homeowner. But what they were still... What they knew was what issues the homeowner might respond to. They didn't know whether it was a visual person or an audio person or a, you know, touch-me-feely person or whatever. They just knew issues. And it's very possible that NLP doesn't really work with logical arguments as much as it does with
it's also
emotional framings.
A lot of this, I think what Richard is saying is, like, it's so intuitive. First of all, it's so intuitive. This idea is extremely intuitive. We should all be familiar with it on some level. But NLP is, like, proclaiming that it is a new study. But, okay, fine. It is something that was just written down in the last 30 years, but that doesn't mean that, like, even the NLPers reject, like, the science.
Right.
But, like, what they are into is the nuance of neuro-linguistic programming, and that is the advantage. It's just that. It's an advantage. You aren't going to convince all of the people using neuro-linguistic programming, but you will gain an advantage when using it.
An advantage, in the sense, and that's why the first books on NLP really had the word magic in the title.
Yeah, but it was a history of
a history of magic. I mean, they consider it magic. Why? Because that's what they're saying magic is. That magic is making people believe stuff. Magic is either misdirection or
it's the or it's like an optical illusion for your brain. Well, I guess an optical illusion is for your brain. But like,
I don't know, it's all negative, like the stuff, I don't know if it's true or not, but you know, if you have the visual and the auditory and the tactile people, like, that's a way to help you communicate with people.
And it's a way to help you be, I mean, get over things that are your problems. I mean, this thing of a person not being able to recognize a door if it doesn't have a handle. You know, that's like, all right, that's something we can work on, you know, because there are these other kinds of doors. So it's like someone not being able to recognize an opportunity if it doesn't have, you know, a gray-haired middle-aged man is the boss. It's like, well, no, actually, there's other job opportunities for you. We're not being able to recognize, you know, a potential mate unless they, you know, have this certain set of behaviors that they now that they've always associated with a potential mate.
But also in the Tony Robbins essay, one of the more interesting things for the readings, I think, he talks about how he took, like, there are several courses you can take to be a trainer or, like, intermediate, but they, you know, Harvey discusses that they really should be, there's no order to them or whatever. But he said that he, Tony Robbins said in his essay about the history of NLP, he talks about how when he first tried it with someone, he seriously damaged them.
Yeah.
And he doesn't explain what that means.
Yeah,
it just
pissed me off.
But when you read that, you think,
what's,
like,
what's that? That's so you don't go try it on your own.
Like, yeah,
that was
but that's the point. I think he did maybe try something, but he didn't seriously damage them. By putting that specific example in, that shows the power of it. Like, it was so dangerous when I tried it.
Yeah.
I read that the early chapters of Coercion, where it's like, okay, guess what? If you look back at what I said earlier, I set up a scenario.
But he didn't disclose it.
He did a little bit, though. I mean, I was like reading this, and I was like, oh, give me a break. Like, he's really talking very colloquially and non-academically, and like bringing us over to his side. And then he's like, I find it works scarily well. So he creates this mystery where, like, whatever we're gonna find out is gonna be really, really
scarily well.
And, you know, and then he's like, I almost damaged them, and then I wrote the fucking bullshit process, because I felt the whole way down this was basically, in, I guess it's not really NLP, but just trying to convince us, you know. I felt like it took away from the idea that neurolinguistic programming is a model that we can improve our techniques of, and I think it actually just kind of made it more like, I have the magic bullet, you know, this is
right.
Which is
cheap sales technique.
Yeah.
And not even NLP, just...
And is that NLP?
It's not that good, if it is. I don't think you can really just do NLP. I don't think you can write a piece of paper and hand it to the world and say, here, you know, and that it's an NLP thing. I mean, there are people using, you know, Milton Erickson's inductions, you know, like Reagan tried to during the debates, and when people tell stories and certain kinds of commercials, but real NLP, I would agree, is a two-way communication. You really do need something on your target in order to do this stuff.
What did Reagan talk to you?
Reagan, I think I put it in the Coercion book. He just told this series of nested stories about driving up the Pacific Coast Highway with Nancy and remembering a dream that he once had about America being like this thing, and in the dream someone told him a story about Bella.
Not because he was going senile.
It could be, but apparently it was part of a planned speech, but then he did an induction on himself during it.
Yeah,
he hypnotized himself when he got kind of lost, and he was like, God bless America.
I think that was his Alzheimer's.
It was like him against Mondale or someone. I mean, it was probably his Alzheimer's too, but he wasn't going off script. He was just... He was listening. He shouldn't have listened to himself as he spoke. That's a lie.
He messed himself up.
Did you do? No. Move a chair. You were talking about your
I have two examples, but one I think is better just because you just mentioned how NLP was associated with magic. And I was looking at this book on Amazon called like Words for Magic, and it's about psychotherapy and NLP. And the beginning of the book, you know, it's how Amazon has, like, what's inside the book.
Yeah.
The beginning of the book, the author is trying to define therapy. And they spend all this time, like, unpacking the term therapy. And then at the end, the author says, I can't define, no words accurately express what I mean by therapy, so what I'd like to do is just cross it out. And so they cross it out. And then they say, but that would be really annoying if I did that, like, throughout the book.
When Tremors were women.
Wait, no, when Words were women.
I'm sure.
Oh,
when
Words were originally
women. That's great.
Those are the good old days.
When Tremors were women. Damn.
words were original to them. And so they go on and on and on about words for magic and this and that, and how they're not satisfied with their own definition of it. And so in the end, they'd like to cross out the word therapy, but then it would be so annoying if they did that throughout the book, so they're not going to do it. But they've done it. You know what I mean? And so now every time, I assume if I would continue to read this book, every time, you know, I come across that word, I'm totally...
Wow, that is interesting. That's great. They read, and now even if chances are if you look at therapy anywhere else,
right, and
you can see it like that.
The only other time I've ever seen someone do that is like in religious texts where you don't say God.
That could actually, but in the beginning, there's a chapter in the Makan, and they're actually taking that from, what is it? I thought maybe you know Heidegger or Derrida. There was the word being. I want to say it was Heidegger. And Heidegger's last text, the idea of the word being, like he spent his whole career on it, and so in his last text, he would cross out the word being. So this is like in reference to that.
It's really effective. I mean, it just becomes not only a way to abstractly own this word, this concept that this person's going to go out and talk about for the next 10 chapters, but, like, it's with such a high degree of specificity.
Yeah. It's a great little stamp, though. It's a visual weird...
The strike through is always used as, not as a, we're striking this because it's wrong, it's to call more attention to what's being striked through. Correction is really the thing.
Although I disagree, like if I'm like working on a document with someone or something in the strike through part, like I ignore it. You know, and like you look at the new stuff, like accept changes, track changes in the word, I think it really does de-emphasize, but in this case
it's color
well, that's,
too.
That's in a collaborative.
It's really
it's something where we send something out to be published. Like a lot of blog posts use these kind of things where they say something really snarky or off color, and then they just cross it out and make a correction.
Yeah, but here it's like they present it as if every time you're going to have to look at that word, it's going to have a strike through. Then they say, well, we're not really going to do it anymore, but it's there. I mean, that is interesting. I mean, they have anchored the word differently, and in doing so, they're trying to recontextualize the way you look at something. I mean, at least they just kind of disclose that they're doing it as they do it. I mean, I object to almost no powerful form of rhetoric. You know, I'm just fine with it. You know, do it. But if you kind of say you're doing it, it's a little bit different than not. That's fine. And he's a therapist. I'm sure they know their shit.
Oh,
it's funny. NLP guys, you know, are a lot like, and some of them are an overlap with general semantics people who are really into sort of language, and they have developed this thing, and Robert Anton Wilson was really into it, called E-prime, which is sort of your being thing. E-prime is a version of, it's just like English, except you're not allowed to use to be or any, what do they call it? Tense of it? Any tense of to be? So you can't say is, but they don't want you to say, John is smart, because it creates an equivalency that's not real. You can say, John demonstrates his intelligence, you know, in his, you know, vast knowledge of literature, but you don't say is, because they just feel that is stupid, you know, that is, they wouldn't say it like that, of course, that is. Because saying is stupid doesn't communicate anything.
So can you say John is a man?
You wouldn't.
So you can't.
Because he's not. When John emerged from his mother's womb, the doctor slapped him on the butt and said, "It's a boy." Right?
No,
because what?
Boy.
He put it in quotes, so he said it. The doctor didn't say that. But no, because John is not a man. According to. General semanticists would say John is not a man. That we have developed a category of human being. We call man, and we assign John to that category. But John is not a man. John is only John.
So it's not a tense. It's just anything to do with the verb to be. It's not a language.
Yeah, because they feel, EPROM people feel, I mean, so they've basically done this to it.
and it's something that really, if you try to write an E prime, really hard. And you realize how many raw equivalencies.
What are books that have written it?
Yeah, yeah. Go to Robert Anton Wilson's site.
The downside of just assigning them things to different categories, even if they're not.
I mean, there's none, as long as you know you're doing it. But it is not, John is not a man. He is not. John's been assigned to that, that word's been assigned to him.
Right. I mean,
what's wrong with using
is? Why did they come up with E prime versus just saying?
Because they feel it creates false equivalencies between things that are not actually equal. Is means equal.
It's not the different things, isn't that the
problem?
I mean,
that's true.
So
it's a speech act, right? It's almost like a command if you're saying, you're like declaring that it's true when, you're forcing.
There's suppositions in it. There's suppositions in it.
You're saying is not, though. How is that? Do they not?
That's,
they're
you
not
can't
able,
do that either.
They have to just.
There's no to be. I mean, sometimes it gets really
absolutely.
In some ways, yeah. It's because they're into semantics instead of all
never,
things.
You can't say never, you can't say always.
In the language of E prime is the only rule. I mean, general semantics goes on and on. It's huge. You can get PhDs in it and stuff. To E prime, that's the only rule of E prime. Yeah. All right, break and come back, and everyone else will have to share their things. Come in with you.
Do me.
Yeah, cool.
Do it. Just play. You ever send me the info that woman that you said did?
Who's this? I think it's cool.
Wow.
So what? No.
No.
No.